Nathaniel Philbrick was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1956, and he received his B.A. in English from Brown University and an M.A. in American Literature from Duke University. Mr. Philbrick first gained fame for a nonfiction classic, In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. This familiarized modern readers, including myself, with a heretofore unknown, for me, harrowing true story that was on which Herman Melville based his novel, Moby Dick. This gripping bestseller won the prestigious National Book Award for 2001. More recently, Mr. Philbrick has revisited the bestseller lists with Mayflower, a story of courage, community, and war, his fresh take on the Pilgrims. This story focuses in particular on the relationship between the Pilgrims and the Native Americans, from the landing to the tragic events of King Philip's War. Mayflower was a finalist for the 2007 Pulitzer Prize in History. Mr. Philbrick has also penned absorbing accounts of the quest to map the Pacific Ocean in Sea of Glory, and also a rich history of his beloved Nantucket in Abraham's Eyes and A Way Offshore, as well as several lighthearted books about sailing, The Passionate Sailor, Yachting a Parody, and A Sunfish Sailor's Odyssey. For the latter, he drew on his thrilling experiences as an NCAA All-American sailor and North American sunfish champion. Mr. Philbrick and his wife, Melissa, are the parents of two children, and they live on Nantucket Island, Massachusetts. Now please welcome Mr. Philbrick to Brigham Young University.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's true I'm known for books about the sea, but I grew up in that maritime center of the universe, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it was in third grade when I first learned in any kind of depth the story of the Pilgrims. It was about this time of year, and our teacher said, "It's time for the Pilgrim unit. Thanksgiving is approaching." And she divided the class into half of us Indians, half of us Pilgrims. I wanted to be an Indian. She made me a Pilgrim. And she told us how in 1620, the Mayflower left with 102 Pilgrims aboard. And in my third grade imagination, I had those 102 people sort of up on the deck clutching the gunwale. And they left, and as they were approaching New England, they put together something known as the Mayflower Compact, our teacher said. Now, I wasn't sure if a compact had to do with cosmetics or anything, but then it became clear that no, this was a document. And so, in my mind's eye, they had something akin to the tablets. And as they approached New England, they were headed for a rock, Plymouth Rock. I saw this as the size of Mount Rushmore. And this is where the story became something like synchronized swimming, because as they approached the rock, they all leapt almost simultaneously onto the rock, where they were greeted by the Native Americans who taught them how to plant corn, and a year later, they celebrated the first Thanksgiving. Well, that's what I learned in third grade about the Pilgrims and the Mayflower, and throughout elementary school, middle school, and high school, that's pretty much everything I learned, because it seemed in my history education, the next event of any importance was the American Revolution, more than 150 years later. And there's a lot of distance there. And I also have to admit to having been a somewhat cynical and rebellious child of the 60s. And by the time I was a teenager, I began to think of the Pilgrims as, you know, stereotypes that might look good on a Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade float, but what did they have to do with the tortured soul of the nation I was beginning to know? You know, they had funny hats with buckles in them. They had shoes with buckles in them. That's why their pants fell down. They didn't have any buckles. No, sorry. Just a little Pilgrim humor. No more. Just a little. And what was going on? Well, about 21 years ago, my wife and I and our kids were then 1 and 4 moved to Nantucket Island. And part of the reason my history education was so deficient was that I'm an English major. And my personal Bible was Moby Dick. And moving to Nantucket was like stepping into the pages of that novel. Walking up the cobbled main street and seeing the extraordinary architecture that was created on this island, because in the early 19th century, Nantucket was the whaling capital of the world, when whale oil is what petroleum is for us. This was the mobile oil headquarters of its day. This is a little island 30 miles out to sea. And this was also a profoundly Quaker island. These were a people that had a sense of not only commercial destiny, but religious destiny. And this was a holy occupation for them. And it contributed to the island's extraordinary success. And I became fascinated with how this place became this place. And I began to research the history of my adopted home. And I realized that if I was going to understand Nantucket, I'd have to put it in the context of New England as a whole. I needed to return to the beginning of New England history. I had to go back to the Pilgrims. But hey, I knew about the Pilgrims because I had learned about them in third grade. Well, it didn't take me long to realize that I hadn't learned everything about them. For the first time, I began to read in any kind of depth the original documents from that period. Top of the list is William Bradford's Of Plymouth Plantation, one of the great books of American history and literature. And as I began to read this, sources associated with the 17th century, I began to realize, wait a minute, the story of the Pilgrims and the Mayflower does not end with the first Thanksgiving. That is just the beginning of a story that, rather than being this benign exception to the rule of American history, is very much in the American grain. Because yes, there is the voyage of the Mayflower. There is the first Thanksgiving, and I'll be talking about that a little more, which comes to us encrusted in myth. But there are some real kernels of historical truth that are part of that myth. And then there is a period about which I think most Americans know very little, more than 50 years of peaceful coexistence that existed in Plymouth Colony between the English and the Wampanoag, the native people who were there when the English first arrived. And then in 1675, 55 years after the sailing of the Mayflower, something happened. It all blew up in a conflict known as King Philip's War, a war about which most Americans have absolutely no understanding. It is a war that changed everything in New England. Because up until this time, there had been an uneasy but a half-century-long peace. By 1675, things had changed in Plymouth Colony. In the beginning, both sides, on the English and the native side, realized they needed each other to succeed in the ever-changing world of the New World. But as with each decade, as more and more land went into the English hands, attitudes began to change. This is very much a generational story. And when the conflicts that had always existed reached the boiling point in June of 1675, and violence broke out, and Philip, son of Massasoit, the Wampanoag sachem that had formed an alliance with the Pilgrims, his son Philip would lead his people in a war, which is, of course, named King Philip's War, that would decimate the region. It began in Plymouth, but very quickly spread throughout New England. And this is at a time when there were about 50,000 English and 20,000 Native Americans in the region. Within a matter of months, more than a third of the towns in New England would be burned and abandoned. Many of the English feared by the winter of 1676 that they were going to be driven to the sea. And then a war that was being won in many ways by the Indians would change radically by the spring of 1676, when they could not plant their crops. They began to starve to death by the summer. And the English had the mother country. They had England to provide them with provisions and weapons. And so it became a war of attrition. Native resistance collapsed. And in August of 1675, Philip was taken and killed almost in the shadow of his ancestral home in Mount Hope in modern Bristol, Rhode Island. And thus ended King Philip's War. But this was no victory for the English. They would be paying for this conflict for decades to come. New England had enjoyed a remarkable independence from the mother country throughout this first half century. But with this war, that would all change. They had to look to the mother country to pull themselves together. A royal governor was instituted soon after. And you can say that many of the seeds of what would create the American Revolution were sown with King Philip's War. And so with Mayflower, I wanted to start with a voyage that we all know about and take it to another voyage, because there's an element to the Pilgrim story that 20 years ago I would have never believed that existed, but it's true. You don't think of slavery as something you associate with the Pilgrims. Well, what was happening during the war? This is a war that was incredibly bloody in terms of percentage of population killed. It was twice as bloody as the American Civil War. The war most of us are taught is the worst ever fought on American soil. And that's just in terms of the English losses. When you look to the native losses, that's a drop in the bucket. And those Native Americans that were not killed or forced to leave the region, those that were captured, many of them were crowded onto ships and sailed to the Caribbean, where they were sold as slaves to the sugar plantations. There is one ship, the Seaflower, that departed in September of 1675 with 180 Native Americans bound for the sugar plantations of the West Indies. And we know that there is one ship that, because by late in the war, sugar plantation owners decided they didn't want Native slaves that had already shown a willingness to revolt. And there was one vessel that was forced to sail all the way to Africa before their cargo was disembarked. And that is a transatlantic voyage of a very different sort from the Mayflower. And so with this book, I wanted to connect those two voyages. How did we get from the Mayflower to the Seaflower? Because we think of the Indian Wars as a 19th century phenomenon, part of the winning of the West. But it all happened in Plymouth in a 56-year period, and in miniature is in many essential ways the history of America. And I'd like to now read to you a passage that takes us to the beginning of the story. It's the first chapter is entitled "They Knew They Were Pilgrims." Now, like so many things associated with the story, the things we assume to be the case have nothing to do with what actually happened. They never called themselves the Pilgrims. That comes from William Bradford's Of Plymouth Plantation, in which he says their true destination was not of this world. It was heaven. They were but pilgrims on this earth, and thus we have called them the Pilgrims. I think it's a very appropriate name, given that once they came here, they didn't stop moving. Thanksgiving. They never called that meal that we call the first Thanksgiving a Thanksgiving. That was introduced in the 19th century. Instead of a Thanksgiving, it was more like a traditional harvest festival, common in any village back in England. It wouldn't have been in November. It would have been in late September, early October. And everything we know about it comes from one letter written by Edward Winslow, a paragraph in that letter. And he makes no mention of turkeys. He does say that they had ducks and geese. And I don't know about you, but I grew up with this sort of Courier Knives image of the first Thanksgiving. There is a long table with a remarkably neat tablecloth on it, a big turkey in the middle of it, with the pilgrims grouped around the table, just a few Native Americans looking on. And, you know, this is sort of the warm-up for dinner with the in-laws that we all have experienced. But this is where history always trumps myth, because by the fall of 1621, celebrating a year in the New World, half of the pilgrims had died. They were just over 50 of them left. There were close to 100 Native Americans who were part of this. And so the Wampanoags outnumbered the English 2-1. This was a profoundly Native event from a demographic point of view. There wouldn't have been enough furniture for everyone. This was an outdoor festival, more like Woodstock than the image that comes down to us. And I think this is essential to what history reveals. The world is a complex, often scary place, and it was then. And people are doing their best, and their spontaneous best is often the best that we human beings have. Well, as a long introduction, let's go to the beginning. For 65 days, the Mayflower had blundered her way through storms and headwinds. Her bottom a shaggy pelt of seaweed and barnacles, her leaky deck spewing salt water onto her passengers' devoted heads. There are 102 of them, 104 if you counted the two dogs, a spaniel and a giant slobbery mastiff. I got an email from a mastiff owner who said that after years of walking around with this dog in a towel, she read this passage and felt a vital connection to the pilgrims. Most of their provisions and equipment were beneath them in the hold, the primary storage area of the vessel. The passengers were in the between or tween decks, a dank, airless space about 75 feet long and not even 5 feet high that separated the hold from the upper deck. The tween decks was more of a crawl space than a place to live, made even more claustrophobic by the passengers' attempts to provide themselves with some privacy. A series of thin-walled cabins had been built, creating a crowded warren of rooms that overflowed with people and their possessions. Chests of clothing, casks of food, chairs, pillows, rugs, and omnipresent chamber pots. There was even a boat cut into pieces for later assembly, doing temporary duty as a bed. They were nearly 10 weeks into a voyage that was supposed to have been completed during the balmy days of summer. But they had started late, and it was now November, and winter was coming on. They had long since run out of firewood, and they were reaching the slimy bottoms of their water casks. Of even greater concern, they were down to their last casks of beer. Due to the notoriously bad quality of the drinking water in 17th century England, beer was considered essential to a healthy diet. And sure enough, with the rationing of their beer came the unmistakable signs of scurvy, bleeding gums, loosening teeth, and foul-smelling breath. So far, only two had died, a sailor and a young servant. But if they didn't reach land soon, many more would follow. They had set sail with three pregnant mothers. Can you imagine? Elizabeth Hopkins, Susanna White, and Mary Allerton. Elizabeth had given birth to a son, appropriately named Oceanus, and Susanna and Mary were both well along in their pregnancies. It had been a miserable passage. In mid-ocean, a fierce wave had exploded against the old ship's topsides, straining a structural timber until it had cracked like a chicken bone. The Mayflower's master, Christopher Jones, had considered turning back to England, but Jones had to give his passengers their due. They knew next to nothing about the sea or the savage coast for which they were bound, but their resolve was unshakable. Despite all they had so far suffered, agonizing delays, seasickness, cold, and the scorn and ridicule of the sailors, they had done everything in their power to help the carpenter repair the fractured beam. They had brought a screwjack, a mechanical device used to lift heavy objects to assist them in constructing houses in the New World. With the help of the screwjack, they lifted the beam into place, and once the carpenter had hammered in a post for support, the Mayflower was sound enough to continue on. Now, who were these people we call the pilgrims? Well, they were a group of what would have been known as religious extremists in England in early 17th century. They were Puritan separatists. This meant that they believed that for them to worship God as God intended, to purify the church, they must separate themselves from the Church of England. Unfortunately, this was an illegal act in England at the time. And so they were forced to emigrate to the more religiously tolerant country of Holland. They went to Amsterdam and eventually made their way to Leiden, Holland, then a college town as it is today. And under the charismatic leadership of their minister, John Robinson, The congregation over the next decade would swell to an estimated 300 people. But everything was not perfect in Leiden. They were able to worship as they wanted to, but because they were foreigners, they were forced to take poor jobs in the cloth industry, often working dawn till dusk with their children by their side 6 days a week, and their health was beginning to suffer. There was a treaty with Spain that was about to come due, and it was feared that Spain was going to attack Holland, and this could be terrible. But their biggest concern involved their children. Their children were becoming Dutch. And even though they had resolved to leave their mother country, they were fiercely proud of their English ancestry. But they couldn't go home. What to do? After much discussion, they decided they should do what seems an incredible thing. They should transplant their congregation wholesale across 3,000 miles of ocean to the New World. Who cared if the only successful English settlement in America was Jamestown? Was hardly a success. It had been a killing ground for its settlers, a sinkhole for its investors. Who cared? They knew that this is what God wanted them to do. And so these people knew each other wonderfully well. They had a spiritual bond, which would be talked about in Leiden years after they left. They knew each other wonderfully well, but when it came to the outside world, they had a hard time reading the motivations of those that were not part of their world. They were the perfect mark for dividing this group of Puritan separatists from their money when it came to planning a voyage across the Atlantic. And sure enough, they would seek out one Thomas Weston, an ironmonger from London, who told them everything they wanted to hear when it came to planning this voyage. He had deep sympathies for their religious beliefs, and he also had the economic connections, the financial connections to make this work with what were known as the adventurers in London, who would finance this voyage. But as the preparations for this voyage proceeded, and by the spring of 1620, Weston had not yet secured them a ship, people began to panic. People began to say, wait a minute, we're going to go eventually, but maybe not this summer. And as more and more of the Leidenders dropped out, the adventurers began to recruit potential settlers in London. These were Church of England people who did not necessarily share the Leideners' religious beliefs. And when finally, after months of delays, the Mayflower left Plymouth, England in September of 1620, there was a divide running down the passenger list of the Mayflower. About half were from Leiden, and about half were what the Leideners called the strangers. And this would create a situation that was completely different from what they had envisioned in the beginning. They had seen themselves as just moving to the New World, keeping that sense of connection and closeness that they had come to require of each other. But no, they were leaving woefully late with a group of strangers. What to do? And this is where John Robinson, their minister, who elected to stay in Holland because the majority of his flock was still in Europe, this is where he would really lay the groundwork for the success of this colony, because he would write what's become known as the Farewell Letter, in which he encouraged the Leideners to not prejudge these strangers, to work with them, because this is the only way the settlement under these circumstances was going to work. And so even though John Robinson would never make it to America, he would die in 1625, perhaps of tuberculosis, before ever having made it over. In many ways, he was the one who laid the groundwork to the future success of the colony. The Mayflower left in September, the worst possible time to go across Atlantic. Westerly gales howling across, buffeting them. Gale after gale. It's been estimated the Mayflower averaged between 1.5 and 2 miles an hour in its slow slog across the Atlantic. More than 10 weeks at sea. By the time they were headed not for New England, but for the Hudson River, The intention was to set up their settlement besides a large navigable river so that they could create a trading operation with the Native Americans for furs. They had to make money if this was going to work. And so the Hudson was where they were headed. Since I'm a Red Sox fan, I'm very happy that they were more than 200 miles off course when they first made landfall in Cape Cod. Master Jones decided, well, I got to head south for the Hudson River. Unfortunately, there were no reliable charts at this point, and it wasn't long before the Mayflower blundered into Pollock Rip, a very dangerous piece of shoal water. Should have been the end of the ship, which drew 11 feet. But then something remarkable happened. The wind shifted from the north to the south. This gave Master Jones the ability to extract his ship from this navigational hazard, and he made an historic decision. He said, I'm not taking these people to the Hudson River. I'm going around the tip of Cape Cod, which was right where they were, and I'm going to get them off my ship as quickly as I can. Now, this created bedlam down below among the passengers, because as some of the strangers pointed out, their patent, their legal right granted them from the king to create a settlement in the New World did not apply to a settlement this far north. As some of the strangers pointed out, they were on the verge of becoming some of America's first illegal immigrants. And they said, once we get to land, all bets are off. We will pursue our own freedom and leave the rest of you. Now, this would have been a disaster. Without them working together, it was now November. It was freezing cold. They knew nothing about where they were. If they did not work together, they didn't have a chance. They could have looked to their military officer, Miles Standish, to subdue those strangers and make them stay with them. But instead, they did what I feel is a remarkable act. They put pen to paper and drafted what we call the Mayflower Compact, in which saints and strangers alike agreed to submit to the laws enacted by their duly elected civil officials. And when you read the Mayflower Compact, it's clear that they are basically cribbing from the letter provided them by John Robinson. And this is where Robinson really gave them the gift that would make Plymouth possible. Here they are. They're in the Cape Cod. It's late in the year. They know nothing about where they are. If they lose a month searching for a large navigable river on Cape Cod, believe me, there are no large navigable rivers there. And in the process, they would do everything wrong when it came to the native, trying to develop a relationship with the Native Americans. They would find some corn buried in the sand. They knew it was of obvious value to its owners, but they were fearful that their own grains brought from Europe might not take to these alien soils, so they stole the corn. They came across some elaborate native graves. They knew, in their own words, that it would be odious to these people to ransack their sepulchers, but they were curious. They ransacked their sepulchers. And a few days later, when they made it to what's now known as First Encounter Beach in modern East Ham, Cape Cod, they found themselves trading shots with an estimated 35 to 40 Native Americans. No one seems to have been hurt, but it was clear that this was not the way to introduce yourselves to a Native population. They would eventually settle in Plymouth Harbor. There's no large navigable river there, but it would have to do. And what appealed to them about it was that the ground was cleared, but there were no one living there. And what they would eventually learn is that during the 3 years that they had been planning this voyage, a group of epidemics introduced by European fishermen in Maine had worked their way down the Atlantic coast, killing in some instances 90% of the native people. What we call Plymouth Harbor was Patuxent to the Indians, and home to an estimated 2,000. When they arrived, no one was there, just the whitened bones of the dead scattered among the interior of the country. And this is where the pilgrims attempted to create a new life. It wasn't long before 2 to 3 were dying per day. As spring approached, they feared that the Indians were just waiting them out, waiting until enough had died that this would be the end of it. But then that spring, Massasoit did an extraordinary thing. He made overtures of peace to create an alliance with this English, this pitiful group of English people, because he realized that they could be of some use to him. His people had been devastated by disease, but the neighboring Narragansetts, his enemies, had been left untouched and were threatening to take his people over. Perhaps an alliance with these English, with their new technology, would provide him with a way to maintain his people's cultural integrity. And so, because of Massasoit's actions, this group of English people, who would not have been able to survive that first winter without the Indians' help, were given a reprieve. And thus was begun what would be 50 years of peace. As I said earlier, things would change in the generations to come. And this is a generational story. And I think it's William Bradford who, for me, personifies what is the extraordinary accomplishment of Plymouth Colony, but also the great sadness and tragedy of this colony. Because you would have thought that William Bradford, late in life, would have taken great pride in what he had wrought with this colony. But no, he was very sad, and because all he wanted out of this colony was to recreate what they had had back in Leiden, that spiritual bond. But as the colony grew, many of his best friends, the people he had relied upon in the early years of the colony, would create other towns in New England. And as they did that, create other churches. And as he would say, the church that had started all in Plymouth would become the abandoned old mother. And he saw that land, he said, would be the ruin of New England. These towns were created for wealth. And this was not what this was about. And so when he died as an old man, he saw the writing on the wall in many ways. He saw that God would, with his rod, would discipline his people. And so that, yes, there was that great promise, but it would, with the next generation, all of that would change. And I would like to finish by reading a passage that I think speaks to sort of that tortured legacy of Plymouth Colony, of the remarkable spiritual bond that held these people together, that provided them with the means to create what would become the toehold for America, but also the sadness and true terror that was part of what they did. And just to set this quote up, this is after they have signed the Mayflower Compact, and just as they're putting that together, and they're now sailing into Province, what we call Provincetown Harbor, a huge space. They know nothing about where they are. Master Jones guided the Mayflower into Provincetown Harbor, one of the largest and safest natural anchorages in New England, tucked within the curled wrist of the Cape. The harbor is a vast watery amphitheater, as many as 4 miles across in some sections. Jones estimated that it could accommodate at least 1,000 ships. But on the morning of November 11th, they were the only vessel in the harbor. Jones found a deep spot with good holding ground, hard up on what is known today as Long Point. No matter from what direction the wind blew, the Mayflower was now safely at anchor. And Jones, exhausted from 2 days of struggle on the New England coast, must have soon retired to his cabin. Many of the passengers were no doubt eager to set foot on land once again. All were thankful that they had finally arrived safely in America. And yet it was difficult for them to look to the future with anything but dread. There were 3,000 miles of ocean between them and home. The closest New England communities in America were more than 500 miles away. They knew that Master Jones was already impatient to get them off his ship and head the Mayflower back for home. But the land that surrounded them was low and sandy, a most unpromising place for a plantation. Bradford called it a hideous and desolate wilderness. They knew they had friends back in Holland, but Thomas Weston, the ironmonger who had helped organize this voyage, if his reaction was any indication, the merchant adventurers in London could not be counted on for much support, financial or otherwise. More immediate concern was the attitude of the native people of this place, who they feared were readier to fill their sides full of arrows than otherwise. Years later, Bradford looked back to that first morning in America with wonder. "But here I cannot stay and make a pause," he wrote, "and stand half amazed at this poor people's present condition. They had now no friends to welcome them, nor inns to entertain or refresh their weather-beaten bodies, no houses or much less towns to repair to seek for succor. In the next 4 months, half of them would be dead. But what astonished Bradford was that half of them would somehow survive. What could now sustain them, Bradford wrote, but the Spirit of God and His grace? May not and ought not the children of these fathers rightly say, 'Our fathers were Englishmen, which came over this great ocean, and were ready to perish in this wilderness. But they cried unto the Lord, and He heard their voice and looked on their adversity.'" Thus begins America. Thank you very much.